Brainseeker Consulting sucht ein CFO, Director Finance, MVD in der Nähe vom Bodensee. Interessenten bitte direkt bei Tom Heinkel über LinkedIn melden. Vielen Dank.
If you would like to record an episode to promote something, please contact Tom Heinkel through LinkedIn. My guest today is Richard Abulafia from Washington, D.C., from the company Aerodynamic Advisory. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
Well, we're going to see each other, hopefully, at the ILA in Berlin coming up a couple of weeks. And you've been there before, right? When was your first time in Berlin?
Yeah, I mean, in Berlin as a tourist before this, but in Berlin for ILA, it was 1998. I remember very well. And it was fascinating because it was just a few years after the end of the Cold War, the end of the Soviet Union. And, well, there were starting to be points of contact between the West and the East. And the theme of ILA back then was Gateway to the East, which sounded great in German. It sounded good in English, too, and kind of filled us with promise that maybe there could be an even larger globalized world of aerospace.
So I can see, well, and the listeners can listen, that you have a great experience in our branch, more than 38 years. Is that correct?
Yeah. My 1988 was when I started in the industry, and 1990 was my first air show, Farnborough, 1990. So I guess you could say, having done exactly nothing other than aerospace, I guess I've had a lot of experience with it.
Yeah, we're going to talk about the aerospace market, about the defense market. You're one of the global experts from these markets, and space market maybe as well. If we have a look at your curriculum, where have you been? What have you done? You've mentioned to me that you also have been at the NATO in Belgium, and you've been in Europe in the 80s. Is that correct?
Well, I wish I could have done that in a professional capacity, but back in the 80s, I got my master's degree in war studies from King's College, University of London, enjoyed it immensely, and spent a summer in Belgium and spent some time talking with people about my master's thesis, which was tremendously relevant for the time, which was the destruction of Second Echelon Warsaw Pact forces coming through the Fulda Gap. And, you know, the meanings from a defense technology development standpoint. So I guess it just goes to show if you wait long enough, something that has been forgotten is suddenly perhaps relevant again.
Mm-hmm. And how comes that you're fascinated by this branch? Did it start as a kid or in school, or did you want to become a pilot, or what is it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was never fascinated by the idea of being a pilot. I always thought best left to the professionals, and I'm not a great driver, so why should I be a good pilot, right? But, you know, my father was in World War II, and, you know, hearing his stories about the importance of air power, that was certainly a factor. Being a kid in the Cold War, right? I mean, I think very few people who grew up in the 60s and 70s wouldn't be fascinated by everything going on. And that confluence of geopolitics and technology and strategy. And I was incredibly fortunate to be able to study that, maybe less fortunate after things wound down and all of a sudden it was like, huh, what do I do for a living now? But thankfully, that's where I got more into civil aerospace. But happy memories of learning about all of these things.
Great. And if we talk about Aerodynamic Advisory, about your company, how many people work for your company as consultants, and how long does it exist?
Yeah, my good friend and co-managing director, Kevin Michaels, founded the company, I believe, in 2016. He had run a company before that and been an executive in the industry, too. I joined in January 1st, 2022, so 4.5 years. And we've got 17 people. I'm deeply privileged to be working with these amazing people. We have one great guy in your hometown there, Klaus Mueller in Hamburg, mm-hmm. and another European based up in Oslo, Norway, Jonas Mirby, and a few people here in Washington, D.C., and everyone else is in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right. So your focus is the U.S. and the European market, or are you acting global?
Yeah, we're global. We do a fair amount in Asia these days because, quite frankly, people in Asia have just the same ambitions towards defense and aerospace development and sovereignty as people in Europe do for very understandable reasons.
Mm-hmm. But what I can see is that you are an expert quite often on TV, on CNN or different interview magazines as well. And you're going to Berlin as an advisor or what is your aim to be there? You're asked from different persons, from different companies. You're going to meet your customers for sure. But what is your main aim? What is your task for the ILA in Berlin now?
Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by this year's ILA for reasons that are, I think, maybe concerning but understandable, that there's needed to be such an increase in defense spending and sovereignty in Europe. And a lot of the center of that is Germany, which I think is admirable and understandable. Absolutely, I can fully support it. But obviously, the various companies in the supply chain, as well as at the top, are concerned about how to do this, how it plays out. And, we have clients in the industrial and financial worlds who are interested in how this all plays out in terms of programs, in terms of timing, and what it means for export markets and everything like that. So it's intelligence gathering. I'm also privileged to be on the speaking bill for the Berlin Aviation Summit just before ILA. Everyone gets their 10 minutes, as they say. As Andy Warhol said about fame, I get my 10 minutes, and I'm looking forward to presenting the aerodynamic view of the industry and markets.
Interesting. Let's go a little bit deeper into that, the defense opportunities for Europe, for example. What is your view on that market before we talk about other market segments?
Yeah, it's gotten a lot more complex, right? I mean, back in the 80s when I was, again, privileged to study, it was about platforms and it still had a lot of bending metal, going on. These days, in terms of what's required, it's gotten far more complex. So when we're talking about surveillance and reconnaissance and the importance of monitoring what's going on with potential adversaries, it's no longer a question of taking aircraft and loading them up with film and recording things. It's now having sovereign technology stacks that allow for real-time data transmission from satellites to ground terminals and having a robust architecture that allows you to maintain your own surveillance and reconnaissance. So it's gotten far more complex in terms of hardware and software and domains. It's no longer just air and ground. It's obviously space and cyber and everything like that. So the requirements and the opportunities are so much greater.
Mm. And if you have a look at the supply chain, we could compare maybe from Boeing and Airbus, for example. What is your view on that? Do you have a special opinion about these companies or maybe other companies like Raytheon, for example? What are the key players for your point of view?
Well, despite the challenges that have resulted in, I suppose, sovereignty and decoupling and whatever else, it's still a global industry and people are dependent upon the same global sources and therefore the same potential bottlenecks. So the problems people are focused on, for example, titanium milled product, obviously rare earth elements and rare earth magnets. These are some of the biggest limiting factors, and they bedevil Airbus, and they bedevil Boeing, and they bedevil RTX. There's so much that is being done to enhance the industrial output and capacity at the final assembly level, at the tier one, tier two level. And you're seeing so much of that in Europe. It's great to see. Your hometown, again, just enormous. As we like to joke, maybe it doesn't translate, but, the city bird is now the crane, with lots of cranes building new facilities. But at the end of the day, you still have to focus on these industrial bottlenecks that create major challenges, be they semiconductors or coatings or again, milled product or rare earths. So I think attention is increasingly concerned about this and how to replicate these capabilities. And, you know, you look at countries like that don't have defense industries but have big ambitions to fit in with the, you know, I'm thinking here of Canada. You know, one thing they've identified is just, you know, the opportunities associated with various materials and what they can do on that level to help the Western alliance, you know, expand its weapons building capacity.
If you have a look at the supply chain, especially, let's say, in Germany, we had many, many small, medium-sized companies 20 years ago. A number of suppliers decreased, and nowadays, some of the tier one suppliers of Airbus, especially, but also for Boeing, are bigger than the OEM.
Yeah.
Do you see this at an advantage for the market? Because, well, of course, the bigger you are, the more cash you have, the more you can invest in these very, very expensive programs for military or for aerospace as well. But on the other hand, maybe some of the big tier one suppliers, are not willing to do anything the OEM wants from them. How do you see that topic?
Yeah, I mean, great question. And there's good and bad, right? On the positive side, as you say, critical mass means ability to raise capital. And also, with that capital comes the ability to intervene in, say, their own suppliers and help out people who are troubled in the second or third or fourth tier, which used to be the problems for primes and governments. Now, people in that middle tier can help out. They're also better able to innovate because they've got better R&D departments and more R&D funding, which is important because so much of the innovation in this industry depends upon, you know, the people who build turbines or electronic warfare or what have you. Now, the downside is, yeah, absolutely, they can push back against the primes. And sometimes they have, not to name names here, but sometimes they have different investment drivers. So, for example, if you're heavily driven by the aftermarket, increasing capacity for new build might be damaging your aftermarket, so maybe you're less willing to invest. Again, not naming names here. But this is indeed, you know, a double-edged sword or a two-sided coin. Or I tend to think there's more good than bad, but I guess I'm an optimist like that.
If we have a look on insourcing and outsourcing, what is your feeling on that, especially for the big OEMs? You know, there are always waves. Sometimes they try to outsource as much as they can, especially to, well, not only best cost countries, also into emerging markets like India and China, for sure, because they want to sell their products there. That's always the case for Airbus and Boeing airplanes, I would say, for the 737, A320neo, etc. That's why we have all these fine assembly lines there, the suppliers become bigger and bigger, like Tata or other companies, for example, in India. But then there are sometimes periods where they say, okay, we do it on our own because for any reason we for the blue collar workers we need some work, we get the work packages back to us. Do you see this as a problem for the supply chain management of these two OEM, or do you say, well, that's life, that's the same like BMW and Volkswagen and other companies?
You know, I think there's a number of issues at play here. One is it might be less cyclical than we think, and part of it was a pattern for a couple of decades or a decade or so that major chunks of aircraft were indeed outsourced and other systems. But a lot of it just wasn't a sustainable business model. And, you know, people say, Boeing is vertically integrated with Spirit now. No, not really. Boeing is rectifying a mistake they made 20 years ago because Spirit, even when it was well run, just wasn't sustainable from an investment standpoint. aerostructures just don't have the profit margins or aftermarket associated with a sustainable aerospace and defense business. So I don't think anyone's going to return to that model. Airbus, to their credit, didn't outsource as much. They went in that direction, you know, premium aerotech, we're going to separate it. But then they kind of backed away from that, which was smart, right? And while it's okay to outsource build-to-print stuff or stuff with, you know, some limited IP, a lot of it, I think, is just going to be kept in-house for all the right reasons. Now, defense is interesting because this is particularly true for the U.S. You have a lot of the new emerging defense producers that have a mantra of vertical integration. I'm thinking of the new tech companies like Anduril or Shield AI, certainly SpaceX, you know, Palantir, whatever. Which works as long as you have private capital, people willing to give you money. But the second you're listed, everyone's going to want you to specialize and, well, outsource to a greater degree so you get better return on invested capital. That's going to be a driver again. So it's a very complex story. There's no, you know, absolutely this is the way to do it. It's just evolving over time. Now, one thing I will say is that Airbus has a little bit of an advantage because they've not only did they not create that big mistake with aerostructures, but they also created multiple FACOs around the world, final assembly and checkout lines in Tianjin, China, Canada, the U.S., and who knows, probably India at some point. As you say, big ambitions. Boeing doesn't do that. They have no experience in doing that. Maybe they can't, maybe they won't. Maybe they need to think about it for the future. But it makes the issue a lot easier when you're merely establishing these mercantilist transplant facilities to assemble things at a final level.
Mm. And maybe it doesn't fit into the political willingness and strategy right now for, let's say, the minimum for the next 2 or 3 years, right? I don't want to become too much political, but what I understand is even from the German car manufacturers, Trump says, please produce your cars in the U.S. Otherwise, you have to pay taxes or whatever.
That's exactly right. You know, Tom Friedman was a little maybe premature with his world is flat thinking. You know, it's trade barriers have gone up. Industrial policy is back. Absolutely. The kind of political barriers and requirements you just said are definitely back, and as you say, at least for a few years and probably longer.
Probably longer. I have a very easy question on mind from your point of view. I hope you have an answer on that. What, from your point of view, you've just mentioned Premium Aerotech Airbus. Well, I would say, you know, they failed to sell the company to Mubea Aviation, right?
Yeah.
That was in the newspapers. So, to make a long story short, I would say it took a lot of management attention in the last 15 years, minimum, or 20 years, to have these aerostructures experience, let's say, with these different plants in Germany and France, selling them, buying them, finding an investor or whatever. So maybe they were not very, very successful in this special thing. What would you say? What were the biggest mistakes from Boeing in the last 10 or 20 years where you'd say, okay, they did this and this and this wrong? And we just have one example from Airbus. Maybe you have another example from Airbus as well, where you'd say, okay, from my point of view as an advisor, from an aerodynamic advisor, these were the biggest mistakes.
Yeah. Both made, you know, mistakes that were, I think, a lot of people recognized at the time. Both were pretty substantial. I guess it's kind of interesting going back. One of my first visits to Airbus was in the 90s, and it was to Hamburg. And I gave a presentation and said, you know, I think you guys could be tied for number one. Whatever you do, don't launch a super jumbo. the A380, for 99 days, Airbus had a CEO, Christian Streif, I believe, who basically said, my God, we've lost a decade. And he was dead right. not listening to the customer, not listening to the market. Biggest mistake you can make. Airbus has made a full recovery. Everything in their product line is excellent. They're in great shape. You know, you got to watch the future, but right now they've made a great recovery. But it cost them 10 years with this stupid diversion of resources.
You mean the A380 decision?
The A380 decision. It was a disaster. Yeah. It was
too much fuel, too much. What was the biggest mistake in that? Because through this, you know, that the Hamburg plant was, increased the size, and they got more or less 1 billion from the state. I understand. I got your point, Richard. But what would you say the biggest, because the market didn't need this airplane, right?
Or what is it? It did not. It wanted the opposite of this airplane, which the A350 XWB is kind of the opposite of that airplane. It's a very good airplane. And the A321neo, of course, also, you know, is the opposite of that airplane.
True.
The world does not resemble Frankfurt. No offense to Frankfurt, but not everyone wants to change planes in Frankfurt.
Got it. Yeah, so you didn't believe this 20-hub global strategy they mentioned before, right?
And they shouldn't have believed it either. There was no reason to believe it.
Got it.
None. And when Boeing launched the 787, another very good airplane, their message was, no, people want to fly point-to-point. And
true.
The irony is the 321neo is now the most incredible point-to-point machine on the planet. So, you know, it works.
But how comes that they don't manage the ramp up well?
Airbus?
From Airbus. Airbus A320neo.
Well, a lot of what they're doing, it's a lot of the problem is 321neo and the new interior configurations required to do a wider variety of medium and long haul trips or missions. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, Airbus's problems aren't that different from Boeing's, which is that they've got very big supply chain issues. So you look at, I remember last November, they suddenly said, it's not 820, it's 790. And it's like, okay, what accounts for the 30-plane shortfall? And in all my years, I'd never heard of the Spanish fuselage contractor that was blamed. Like, who are they? What? You know, I know all the Spanish players. Who are these guys? And it's always something. You know, I'm the old joke, how many parts does it take to build a plane? Well, all of them, you know. You know, so it's one thing. I don't blame Airbus. You know, Airbus had the slowest growth of anybody last year, and I'm concerned about that, not because of Airbus. I'm concerned about that because it might be a reality of when you're the biggest player and you're dependent upon the supply chain, maybe your growth's going to have to be a lot slower because of all the various structural bottlenecks in that supply chain.
I understand. And if we have a look at the defense market, I think this will be very important for the ELA in Berlin as well, for sure. What's your view on that, especially nowadays for all these wars going on? What would your advisory to investors or to people who are acting in that market? Why are we so slow in Europe from your point of view?
Well, you know, you've got an industrial base that's sized for the post-Cold War downturn. And not everybody is recognizing the demand signals that are, I think, coming from the German MOD and other organizations. So as a result, you've got people who are willing to invest doing better. You know, think Embraer, think Saab, think Korea Aerospace Industries, people who are saying, all right, we're going to invest. And there are companies in Germany, Rheinmetall leading the way, I think, that are really doing a great job in expanding their global industrial footprint. Really tremendous. And there are companies there that are just well-placed. You know, I think the fastest growth defense stock in the history, in recent history, was Hensoldt in February 2022. You know, just, oh my God, wow. So I think as people accept that the demand signals are there, that arsenals are going to be replenished, and Europe is going to be more of a sovereign actor and going to get its act together on defense procurement, that I think there'll be a faster expansion of capacity. But in the here and now, things are constrained by a badly shrunken industrial base.
Interesting. If you have a look at these markets from global point of view, I mean, what's happening in Africa, in Australia, South America, or other parts of the world? Where do you see the biggest opportunities in the defense market?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, right? It's everywhere. Rearmament is pretty across the board because, of course, Europe has, well, everything going on with Russia's Ukraine invasion and Russia in general. The Mideast is sadly the Middle East still. And then, of course, Asia is confronted by China and by a U.S. that's frankly pulling back from its alliance relationships. So, you know, take Australia. You mentioned Australia. Great example. You know, in about 15 years ago, I remember you had the Minister of Defense saying, we don't even care about offsets anymore. We just want to buy off the shelf. We're going to come to Fort Worth, put a $100 million bill in the vending machine. We get a fighter jet. We don't care about the rest. And now they're like, oh, no, we want our own sovereign defense industry. We want to build missiles, hypersonic weapons, submarines. We don't care. Collaborative combat aircraft, everything.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are saying this, right? And that, of course, is putting tremendous pressure on everybody's supply chain and talent base.
And, yeah, there are not too many people living in Australia, right?
That's 20, a problem. Biggest million? Problem. At the end of the day, it's labor, right?
Yeah. Well, interesting. I just saw that they have some close cooperation with some German submarine companies, I think. But to be honest, I'm not very, very deep. I don't have a deep knowledge in that market.
Well, you know, you ask what we tell our clients. It's think abroad in terms of new platform opportunities and think in terms of solutions that allow people to develop their own intellectual property. So the days of U.S. companies saying, ah, great, here's an ITAR-based solution, you know, compliant with U.S. international traffic and arms regulations. No. Instead, think about working with countries on a local basis where you work together to develop new technology that they own. Mm.
So what I learned is you're not coming to on June to Berlin. You're coming earlier. Is that correct? You're coming before to Europe?
Well, I'm just – the Berlin Aviation Summit is earlier that week. I'll be staying the whole week, but then coming back a few weeks later just to spend time in Europe with my family and then go to Farnborough. So a lot of the summer I will be in Europe, I'm very pleased to say.
So you're going to miss the World Cup and you're not going to watch soccer in Washington?
Well, but I am expecting my own copy of the FIFA Peace Prize. That's important.
Okay. Where's going that to happen? At the Capitol or what?
Oh, yeah, somewhere like that. Yeah, sounds good.
the Abraham Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, the new pool.
Okay. Please let me know. Then I will travel to the U.S. and be a spectator, the first row, hopefully. That's a good one. So are you interested in soccer or you don't care?
Oh, I'm more of a baseball guy.
Or in sports in general?
Sports, the only sport I really like is baseball because my son loves baseball. So there we go.
Interesting. So if people wants to meet Richard and in person, they come to Berlin to the Aviation Summit. And where can they meet you at the ILA? There are so many people. It's quite difficult, right? They could contact you via LinkedIn in advance. Yes, that's for sure, absolutely. Right? I will put your LinkedIn profile into the show notes. That's for sure. I think that's the easiest way, right? But yeah, you have a walk around, or are you busy from morning to evening?
Nothing I love more than walking around in air shows. So hope to meet as many people as possible. And if not, my favorite bar, the Marine House, which is not too far from the Ausbahnhof. And I do have my favorite Berlin neighborhoods and bars, and it's a wonderful city.
Absolutely. And I was born in Hamburg, raised in Hamburg, live in Hamburg. I can tell you, I love Berlin. Very, very great. And I'm to be honest, quite not proud, but I'm happy that the ILA is so successful nowadays. What I learned is, you know, there are other air shows in Europe, and yeah, of course, I'm happy that the Berlin-based ILA is so successful.
Well, me too. You know, Tom, it's funny. I think back, and the big driver back in 1998 was Gateway to the East. And now the reason ILA, I think, is coming back strong is because of, ironically, the East.
Yeah.
And the requirements for defense spending as a consequence of that. True. So it's ironic and perhaps unfortunate, but it's that driver behind aerospace and the importance of companies to be on the same page and to coordinate at shows like this is going to be strong for a very long time.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, we need it, that's for sure. Companies need it to sell their products, to do marketing, and we need it to have a market overview, for sure, especially from Aerodynamic Advisory.
You're too kind. Thank you.
All right. Richard, famous last words from your side. Did I forget to mention anything? Is there a key message from your point of view to the listeners of the Aerospace Manager podcast?
Well, I think the most important thing from my perspective, the reason I spend a lot more time in Europe these days is because the message, sadly, from the top here in the U.S. has not been pro-transatlantic alliance. And I think the greatest force for peace in the world, perhaps ever, has been the last 80 years of the transatlantic alliance. And in my tiny, 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 tiny part, I'd like to keep that going.
Well, that's perfect. That's the perfect message. I just can sign it for sure. And I would like to say thank you very much, Richard, for your time, for your insights to the aerospace and defense market, and looking forward to meet you in Berlin in person.
Same here. Hope to have a beer with you, Tom.
Thank you. Yeah.
If you would like to record an episode to promote something, please contact Tom Heinkel through LinkedIn.
If you're interested in recording an episode in English or in German, and if you're an exhibitor for the ILA in Berlin 2026, please contact me and we can send you an offer. Thank you for your interest.